Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, June 9th, 2017. So I have been told. This, our debut study session on the late Gil Scott Heron, his autobiography, The Last Holiday, a Memoir. This great follow-up, our weekly book club. We just finished up another autobiography, Coretta Scott King's My Life, My Love, My Legacy. Learned some good things. Not one of my favorite books, but I did learn quite a bit that I didn't know about both she and her husband, Dr. King. The song you heard at the beginning, legendary black genius Stevie Wonder, his song Happy Birthday, which was mentioned in Coretta Scott King's autobiography. She talked about Mr. Wonder's efforts to get a federal holiday for her husband. You hear him talking about it in the song Happy Birthday, and I know some of our listeners said they didn't even know that that song was made as a part of the effort to get that holiday for Dr. King. I'm sure it was before some of our listeners were even alive or, you know, paying attention to what was happening in the world. But Gil Scott Heron's autobiography also deals with the King holiday. He certainly spends a good chunk of time talking about his own life and growing up and how Dr. King impacted his life and understanding of racism. And he also, later on in the book, gets to where he and Stevie Wonder worked together to get the King holiday. Thought it would be a great follow-up. I'm a huge fan of Gil Scott Heron. I'm sure we'll weave in some of his songs. He's going to talk about some of his writing and poetry as we roll with the book. So just looking forward to it and hoping folks get a better understanding of the life, work, experiences, thoughts of Gil Scott Heron, who spent a lot of time using his talents to address the problem of white supremacy. Without further ado, we will get started. Again, this is The Last Holiday, a memoir by Gil Scott Heron, context of white supremacy, audio segment number one. The Last Holiday, a memoir by Gil Scott Heron, published in 2012. Dr. King. I admit that I had never given much thought as to how much of a battle would have to be fought to get most Americans to agree and then say that there actually should be a black holiday. But what a hell of a challenge. How far would Stevie go to make them pass legislation tabled 10 years in a row? I didn't doubt it for a second that the brother was sincere. But how many minds had come together in the last 12 years? How many folks recognized that America had to grow? And who else could convince them that yesterday had to go? I had liked the idea of a minister being around when racing for high stakes to have his foot near the brakes because of what truly could have gone down. I thought America could have blown up before it could ever be said that we had grown up. And for whatever reason were there Americans who never knew that Dr. King prevented chaos and would give him his due. I admired Stevie's enthusiasm and that he spoke his mind, but right does not triumph over wrong every time. Gandhi took nonviolence with him when he died. Over here there was nonviolence, but only on one side. When white folks beat up and killed people that you knew, you might direct your anger at a building or two. Instead of making the Old Testament a civil rights guide and saying that an eye for an eye would now be justified, we were told to accept that some white folk had no class, and instead of condemning white people en masse, we were told remaining peaceful would be the best thing. And directing that philosophy were men like Dr. King. Through a storm of provocation to fight, we saw that in order to change America, you must change the law. They called us militants and radicals and were made to look bad for trying to secure the rights all Americans had. But behind what's often written is where you find the real thing. So America might not have made it without Dr. King. Prologue. I always doubt detailed recollections authors write about their childhoods. Maybe I am jealous that they retain such clarity of their long agos while my own past seems only long gone. What helped me to retain some order was that by the age of 10, I was interested in writing. I wrote short stories. The problem was that I didn't know much about anything, and I didn't take photos or collect mementos. There were things I valued, but I thought they would always be there, and that I would. There was Jackson, Tennessee. No matter where I went to, Chicago, New York, Alabama, Memphis, or even Puerto Rico in the summer of 1960, I always knew I'd be coming back home to Jackson. It was where my grandmother and her husband had settled. It was where my mother and her brother and sisters were all born and grew up. It was where I was raised, in a house on South Cumberland Street that all of them called home, regardless of what they were doing and where they were doing it. They were the most important people in my life, and this was their home. It was where I began to write, learned to play piano, and where I began to want to write songs. Jackson was where I first heard music. It was what folks called the blues. It was on the radio. It was on the jukeboxes. It was on the music of Shannon Street in Fight's Bottom on Saturday night when the music was loud and the bootleg whiskey from Memphis flowed. The blues came from Memphis, too. Shannon Street was taboo at my house, something my grandmother didn't even think about. We never played the blues at home. Our house was next door to Stevenson and Shaw's funeral home. The man who ran that business was Earl Shaw, one of the nicest men I'd ever had the pleasure to meet. His wife was a good friend of my mother, and our families were so close that I related to his children as cousins for years. Evidently, business at the funeral home was good because I remember clearly when Mr. Shaw purchased another building in East Jackson and the movers came to take everything out of the place next door. And then the men from the junkyard came to put everything else in the back of an old truck. My grandmother knew the junk man, and after a brief conversation with him, he directed his two sons to bring an ancient and well-used upright piano into our front room and push it up against the wall. I was 7 years old enough to start learning to play. What she had in mind was that I learn some hymns I'd be able to play for her sewing circle meetings. That's how my music playing started. There was no blues on the living room radio. My grandmother had that one locked on the station that played her soap operas in the afternoon and her favorite radio programs at night. When we got a second radio, it was quickly dubbed the ball game radio. And sure enough, when a ball game was being broadcast, I listened. But at other times, I try to tune in WDIA in Memphis, the first black radio station in the country with on-air personalities like Rufus and Carla Thomas and B.B. King. Late at night, I try to get Randy's Record Show out of Nashville. I heard people talk about a music explosion in Memphis. I knew my favorite music, the blues, came from there too. But I was living in Jackson, 90 miles east of Memphis, and I had no desire to go anywhere else. Until I had to when the family, my mother and I, moved to New York City. Though my mother and I left Jackson in the summer of 1962, I had known the move was coming from the time the new highway was announced. That had been a couple of years and 100 rumors prior. The route the highway would take had sparked hours of conversation. In the end, it came through our neighborhood. A lot of the neighborhood had already been cleared out when we left. Liberty Street Church, just behind us, and Rock Temple, the sanctified church a few blocks away, had already closed up. There had never been many commercial establishments in that direction, and the four lanes were rolling through what had been blocks of aging residences. Soon it would all be gone. I could imagine the rows of gas stations and fast food joints lining what had been my backyard. Easier access for truckers and travelers going west to Memphis and east to Nashville. In a way, this was a prelude to a larger funeral. The paving of America constituted a symbolic burying of the hatchet, a signal that the northern CEOs and southern CE dollars were at long last seeing eye to eye. The Confederacy had finally found co-signers for its 100-year loan and had negotiated its way from Appomattox Courthouse through the gauntlet from apostate around apathy, apology, appeasement, appeals, approbation, apprehension, and appropriation to approval. The southern quadrant of the contiguous country had done a century of icy isolation, and by God, a Negro, had put a blowtorch to the thermostat. Thurgood Marshall had thawed things, battered the last barricade with Brown versus the Board of Education. The financial folks now faced the final frontier. I had played my small part, a ripple in one of the incessant waves that were wearing down the mountain that had been segregation. Together with Madeline Walker and Gillard Glover, I had initiated school desegregation in Jackson. And factories would be built, and highways would uncoil like rattlesnakes from Maryland to the Gulf of Mexico. And Jim Crow, the bastard who had swung 1,000 nightsticks and set 1,000 crosses on fire, was not dead. But he'd been wounded. That time by 3 children, Madeline, Gillard, and me, civilians in a civil war. Since those beginnings, I have not been proud of everything that has happened or that I have done throughout my life. But I consider myself fortunate. I was raised by 2 women, my mother and grandmother, who were both dedicated to my well-being and did everything they could to make sure I had every opportunity to succeed in life. They were dedicated to my book learning and were examples of what I should try to be as an adult and as a gentleman. The mistakes have been due to my own poor judgment, both of people and circumstances. I am the father of 3 children, regardless of rumor and comment to the contrary. My firstborn was my son, Rumal, an anagram that makes use of the letters of his mother's first name. My older daughter is Gia, a soft-sounding word for a very feminine delight. My younger girl is named Chegiana and goes by Che, pronounced She. This book is a chance to share some things with them and other readers, things I hope will be useful. Some of it is purely biographical. The central focus, however, revolves around experiences orchestrated by Brother Stevie Wonder, a true miracle of talent and concern for his fellow man. I was lucky enough to be with him when he set his mind and heart on doing something important, something that a lot of folks thought was impossible, and he got it done. We all need to see folks reach beyond what looks possible and make it happen. We need more examples of how to make it happen. We will all face difficult circumstances along the way that will challenge our self-confidence and try to disrupt our decisions about the directions we wish to choose. I hope this book will remind you that you can succeed, that help can arrive from unexpected quarters at times that are crucial. I believe in the spirits. Sometimes when I explain to people that I have been blessed and that the spirits have watched over me and guided my life, I suppose I sound like some kind of quasi-evangelist for a new religion. I am not and do not have a personal church to promote. I believe, however, to paraphrase Duke Ellington, that at almost every corner of my life, there has been someone or something there to show me the way. These landmarks, these signals, are provided by the spirits. This is not a subject I offer for purpose of debate. Whatever you call the intangible influences that help direct you in your life is not the point. My contention is that your blessings derive from your positive contributions, but they must come from the heart, not because of what you expect in return. Otherwise, what you contributed was a loan, not a gift. I am grateful to dozens of people who helped advance my work over the years and who helped further the accomplishment I am trying to describe here. I hope that will become clear in the descriptions that follow. In the meantime, I would hope this book helps all of us remember to celebrate Brother Stevie Wonder on his own birthday and on January 15th, the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr., every year. 1. Words have been important to me for as long as I can remember. Their sound, their construction, their origins. Because of that interest, there are few places I could have been raised that would have provided more wonderful raw material than the southeast quarter of North America. The word Tennessee means land of trees to the folks native to the part of the world 300 or 400 years ago. Residents of the region respected the land, and their attention to the details of their surroundings stands out in their descriptions. They examined their environment thoroughly, creating drawings of what they saw from a mountain that provided an unobstructed view for miles in all directions. South and east of the mountain, a blanket of treetops led to trails marked by the Seminoles. Due west, the Chickasaw people lived on the banks of the horseshoe-shaped Tennessee River that one encountered twice as it sliced the state into thirds, and everywhere stood dense forests. Tennessee, they say, was once 90% trees, the land of trees. The natives from the heights of the Appalachians scattered when the new folks came into the mountains from the east. These graceless, grimy intruders were more than a different tribe, and less. They were more than a different skin color and language. They had no respect for the land and its inhabitants. Arriving in waves, they attacked the mountains as if to level them. They slashed jagged holes and dammed the streams before thunderous explosions collapsed the face of hillsides, leaving only the ugly scars to evidence their search for the black rocks they called coal. The natives charted their ragged trails of mutilation from the peak above Chattanooga, and they led their families west. When I was a boy in Tennessee, our first class in the morning was geography, and the time was always dedicated to Tennessee and how it was connected to history. Tennessee was the volunteer state. University of Tennessee sports teams were the volunteers. I remember being shown pictures of Davy Crockett and Smokey the Bear. I also recall the slightly curved diagonal line I drew that linked Knoxville to Nashville to the city named after an ancient Egyptian metropolis, Memphis. Memphis, Tennessee was only 90 miles west of Jackson, my home. But Memphis was as far away as the North Pole in my mind. People in Jackson were always talking about somewhere else, mostly Memphis, because it was a close somewhere else and you could drink alcohol there, while Jackson was in a dry county. I talked about going to Chicago, where my mother lived. Some of my grandfather's relatives were in Memphis and I had visited them, but what I remember about the trip was getting carsick and throwing up. The history that we were given about Memphis was done in light pencil that hopscotched its way to a semi-solid landing with Elvis Presley on the Ed Sullivan Show. The city had started as a midway market, a meeting place on the banks of the Mississippi River that squatted in the muck almost squarely between New Orleans and Chicago. As such, it provided a perfect location for traders of all description and from all directions who brought everything to exchange, from furs to furniture and cotton to cattle. As the steamboats and paddle wheelers sought the shallows of Memphis and St. Louis, they stirred great clouds of silt and sand, turning the surface of the waterway a burnished brown. The Mississippi became known as the Big Muddy. The docks at the edge of the village were a magnet for hunters, trappers, farmers, and natives who rolled up in wooden wagons to trade loads of tobacco, produce, and buffalo hides for guns, whiskey, and farm implements. They all walked and rolled past the narrow, squalid shacks, no more than cages, where there were echoes of moans and rattling chains from human cargo. The Memphis Day was from Can See to Can't See, and with the first hint of another sunrise, the procession from the docks to the foul-smelling mud huts beneath the auction blocks began. There, nearly naked black men and women, barely covered by rotting rags, were led in, bound and shackled, with rawhide nooses around their necks. The least cooperative captives were hobbled with ankle chains that limited them to short, stuttering steps. They would be sold, these bucks, to the cutthroat Cajuns from the sea-level swamps. It was said that each year spent in the paralyzing heat of a Louisiana summer took 5 years off a man's life. When a slave was sold to the lords of Louisiana, the observers lamented that he'd been sold down the river. Memphis matured from midway market to a major metropolis. Saloons and whorehouse tents, once soaked with the sweat of drunken sailors and reeking with the acid stench of swine, slime, sewage, and slaves, is now better known for Graceland and the Grizzlies than for Beale Street and the Blues. Its filthy foundation as a headquarters for whores and for humans sold to the highest bidder was obscured by the magic of musical melding. Sun Records considered itself the fuse that lit the 1950s with Elvis and rock and roll. With Carla and Rufus Thomas and Otis Redding, Stax Records brought blues to the hit parade with hooks and horns and a solid beat evolving into Al Green and Willie Mitchell. Memphis meant music. And unless you stop to think for a minute, you might forget that it was in Memphis that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed on a motel balcony on April 4th, 1968. That assassination is one of our starting points. Stevie Wonder did not forget. In 1980, Stevie joined the members of the Black Caucus in the United States Congress to speak out for the need to honor the day Dr. King was born to make his birthday a national holiday. The campaign began in earnest on Halloween of 1980 in Houston, Texas, with Stevie's national tour supporting a new LP called Hotter Than July, featuring the song Happy Birthday, which advocated a holiday for Dr. King. I arrived in Houston in the early afternoon to join the tour as the opening act. I was invited to do the first 8 shows covering 2 weeks, and I felt good about being there, about seeing Stevie and his crazy brother Calvin again. Somehow, it seems that Stevie's effort as the leader of this campaign has been forgotten. But it is something that we should all remember, just as surely as we should remember April 4th, 1968, we should celebrate January 15th. And we should not forget that Stevie remembered. As Stevie sang on Happy Birthday, we all know everything that he stood for, time will bring. For in peace our hearts will sing. Thanks to Martin Luther King. 2. Stevie Wonder could not see. He was blind. Blind was damn near part of his name. From the first time his name was broadcast and the tune's title was tagged, he was stamped Stevie Wonder, the Blind Boy. I knew it was all part of programming, of selling Stevie to the public, but I still felt a little sympathy for the brother because it put something in capital letters he probably didn't need to hear. I had never heard Blind Ray Charles or Blind Jose Feliciano. It couldn't have been because Stevie played an instrument, because Ray Charles played piano and Jose Feliciano played guitar. What the hell? There had been a stretch when brothers and sisters were taking on what they considered religious names. Cassius Clay became Muhammad Ali. Bobby Moore became Ahmad Rashad. In the old days, guys named something else became Rock Hudson and John Wayne. Malcolm Little became Malcolm X. Ma Bell became 9X. And Stevie. Stevie started out carrying a tic-tac-toe of AKAs. He was known as Little Stevie Wonder. When his first top 10 tune turned the American airwaves into his one-man tidal wave, had I been around in those days with a microphone, it would have been a tidal wave. But since his real name was Steveland Morris, he had actually been riding the waves on a fictitious surfboard. He might have been little when he was first spotted by the record executives at some show down in Motown, but by the time he played Fingertips on American Bandstand, he was clearly pushing 6 feet and looked like he could slam dunk Dick Clark. I first had the chance to see Stevie Wonder at the Apollo on 125th Street when I was 15 and living in the Bronx. The young man at the center stage, holding a harmonica and a microphone while urging the crowd to clap their hands, was as tall as I was, and only the dark glasses that concealed his eyes reminded me that his 100-watt smile from inside the bright spotlights was offered to a darkness that began behind his eyelids and not just beyond the footlights. The guy could flat out play, and I hoped the blind part of his introduction would be dropped rather than become attached to him as a professional name like Blind Lemon Jefferson, as though plain old Stevie Wonder was an amateur handle. Stevie continued to grow in all directions, to his full adult height of over 6 feet, but also in the public eye as a wonderful musical talent. An exceptional keyboard player, an enthusiastic percussionist, an inventive and challenging composer of both rousing dance numbers and thoughtful ballads, tunes that stuck with you and came back to you with fresh feelings, he demonstrated his full conceptual grasp as a composer and arranger with his orchestrated score of the movie The Secret Life of Plants. The texture of his voice and vocal range made his every offering as a singer an individual accomplishment. His songs were sung by other artists, but not covered. Throughout the 1960s and 1970s, he remained highly valued as an attraction and was in constant demand. I thought about Stevie often before I met him. Aside from his constant presence on the radio, he spent a good deal of time on my personal stereo. Along with the early look at him I got at the Apollo, I saw him again a few years after that during a summer break from college when I stayed on campus to work as a sort of camp counselor. We took a bus from Lincoln University's Pennsylvania campus up to a New Jersey fairground for 2 hours of Stevie's songs and showmanship. He put on an awesome display of virtuoso performances on a number of instruments. Seeing his growth since 125th Street on harmonica to the master of a variety of keyboards and percussion instruments and the ease with which he handled his singing chores elevated the brother to the top of my ladder as a performer and a talent. His playing, singing, and songwriting had expanded exponentially while he still retained the unrestrained joy that exploded like physical force from his opening notes and lassoed everyone within reach of his frequency of freedom. I had never attributed to Stevie any supernatural powers or felt as though he was visited by aliens or touched by some witch waving a magic wand, but after seeing a couple of his performances, I was definitely captivated by the energy he always generated from the stage. I was glad that by the time I met the brother in the mid-1970s, he was just Stevie Wonder, or Stevie. He had either lost or thrown away most of the ill-fitting descriptives that had been spread over him here and there like ugly coats of paint. Otherwise, I could have ended up at 30 years old sharing the bill with little blind Stevie Wonder. But things worked out. A few years before the offer to tour with Stevie, Clive Davis had invited him to a show we played at the Bottom Line in Greenwich Village in Manhattan. After that, Stevie would show up spontaneously at shows once in a while at the Roxy at the Wilshire Theater, but I never knew he was coming. That was what friends did. They could show up without a royal proclamation and know they'd be welcome. With the kind of schedules entertainers have, it's not odd that things happen spontaneously. You get a minute, you hear somebody's in town, and you want to see them. The bigger the celebrity and the more things they had to do, the more spontaneous things were. I always called everybody Brother Man, and Stevie had his own personal names for people. Soon after we met, he began to call me Air Reese, which was cool because I am an Aries. Meeting him also sent me back to the Bronx for memories of what I had thought of the early little Stevie, and I felt happy for him. It has been a private joy of mine to have felt that kinship with a brother nearly all my life, never caring in the beginning or now when someone might say, "He's blind, you know." That meant the harmonica on fingertips was no sooner settling on Stevie's lips than what inevitably came to their mind for some reason was the brother was blind, which obviously didn't mean a hell of a lot, 'cause it said what he didn't have, but not what he got. His music hit a certain chord and moved you like the pointer on a Ouija board. Your feet made all your dancing decisions and didn't give a damn if he had X-ray vision. So why was it that people always remarked, "He's blind," as though Stevie was condemned to the dark? Suppose you looked at it the opposite way. They had 20/20 vision and still couldn't play. And when they danced, seeing didn't help them keep time. And things like that made me wonder just who was blind. 3. I'm going to have to ask you to accept some information on faith the way I did. For instance, that on the morning of April 1st, 1949, at Provident Hospital in Chicago, Illinois, a very pretty young black woman named Bobby Scott completed a round trip to and from the hospital delivery room. According to the information on the birth record, she gave birth to a child that was a legitimate black male, the tic-tac-toe of birth certificates in that day and age. A lot of people's positions in life changed that day. Birth always directly affects far more people than is readily apparent. Everyone related to either parent gets an additional name to be called. My mother's mother became a grandmother. My late grandfather's sister became a great aunt. My grandmother's brothers became great uncles. Their children became cousins again. And my mother's brother and sisters became an uncle and two aunts. My father's family was affected the same way. His mother and father became grandparents. His 7 brothers became uncles, and their children became cousins. My father, who was originally from Jamaica, and all 7 of his brothers had the middle name St. Elmo. I'm not sure how many of his brothers named their children St. Elmo, but my father decided he wanted to name his son after himself. Name for name, Gilbert St. Elmo Heron. This was cool with my mother up to a point. Using the same first name was cool. The use of the same last name was not only cool, but also fit with the legitimate black male of the birth certificate. But using St. Elmo would have brought the known number of men on the planet with that middle name to 9, which was 1 too many as far as my mother was concerned. Not cool. According to my mother, she had absolutely nothing against St. Elmo or the fire that may or may not have been his responsibility. She did not question the veracity or the sobriety of the many seamen who had reported seeing this flaming phenomenon along the masts of ships at sea. She simply didn't like the name St. Elmo, and she convinced my father that unless the saint came marching in, there would be no Mo. My mother suggested finding another name that started with S so the initials of father and son could remain the same. My father's problem was that he didn't know any other middle name that might go with his last name, all of the Heron men he knew had St. Elmo as a middle name. Then my mother suggested Scott, her maiden name. My father didn't think much of Scott. All the Scots he knew had it as a last name, but he reluctantly agreed. My mother had been named after my grandfather, Bob Scott. Everyone called her Bobby, but her full name was Robert Jameson Scott. Her parents, Bob and Lily, obviously didn't care much about convention when it came to the names of their children. They gave them the names they wanted them to have. Bob Scott had died in 1948 after going blind 10 years before. My grandfather had been an insurance man before and through the worst of the Depression and then began to break down. First, constricted veins blocked circulation in his legs. Then he went blind. He began to lose his grip, slipped, lost his mind, and later became violent and had to be committed to the hospital for the criminally insane at Bolivar, Tennessee. Still, it was probably my father as a Caribbean version of Bob that made him attractive to my mother. Gil, my father, was tall, handsome, well-dressed, and well-mannered. So had been Bob Scott, who always wore a suit for business with a white shirt and a tie, his hat clinged and his shoes shined. Later in life, I remember members of my father's old soccer teams telling me about the zoot suits and wide striped ties Gil would be wearing when he arrived in the locker room. When my mother talked about her youth in Jackson, Tennessee, and going places with Bob Scott, you could hear the pride in her voice and see her eyes shine. The strength of their relationship was obvious. My grandfather had been Steel Arm Bob, a pitcher who bested Satchel Paige's barnstorming team one zip when they came through Jackson. Reading the sports pages to him was how my mother got to know so much about sports and batting averages, the knowledge and real understanding of the details. My father liked that. Gil Heron was young, exotic, and worldly, a veteran of the Canadian Air Force. He was also physical and athletic and went all out when he competed. The Aries fire lit up his face and made it glow. The joy of winning brought a smile that made you feel like you were standing in a bright, warm sun. Sometimes he was romantic and sometimes thoughtful, brooding over the quality of his competition and teammates who couldn't get the ball to him when they were pressed. He loved to talk about soccer, past games, teammates, opponents ridiculed as their pointless, desperate pursuit of him always ended the same way. Goal. Her honesty and curiosity, not naivete, attracted Gil to my mother, Bobby. My mother was the second of four Scott children, a scholar who graduated from Lane College, the black university in Jackson, with an incredible 3.96 grade point average, and then moved to Chicago. She was obviously a pretty and vivacious young lady, a college graduate with a soft drawl and not a bad bowler. They had met at the bowling alley next to the Western Electric plant where they both worked in Chicago. She was slim, but he could see the shapely legs, the firm hips, and the guileless smile. He'd known women who pretended to be sports fans, saying, "I'd love to come down to a game and see you kick a home run." Not her. Not Miss Bobby Scott from somewhere in Tennessee. She knew sports. She even knew about his football. Soccer. Gil would come home after soccer games and rub his legs down with alcohol. Only then would the cuts and scratches and bruises receive the notice they deserved. During games, he was oblivious to discomfort. My mother would be appalled by his injuries. opponents tried to deliberately injure him with high tackles and tackles when he didn't even have the ball. It was inevitable when his team played groups from the surrounding areas. His skills would offend the opposition, often leaving them feeling foolish and flailing, victims of Gill's fancy footwork. There were scoundrels in places like Skokie, a suburb of Chicago, then inhabited primarily by Europeans who treated soccer like an ethnic heirloom. My mother talked about incidents when opposing players had felt forced to foul, going for his legs instead of the ball, not trying to tackle him, but to injure. These were red flags to his temper. Bad move. Gill would grab them and either overpower them with the strength that could be generated by his powerful legs, or, while grappling, face to face, he would suddenly jerk his opponent toward him, forcing their face into his forehead. Once he had been so upset with the blind eye officials who ignored intentional attempts to injure him that he suddenly turned on the ball and kicked it over a wire fence into Lake Michigan, ending the game. Bobby was as worried about fights as she was worried about him getting hurt in games, and those were not related to the same set of circumstances. His reputation, or so the legend goes, was that he handled both of those very separate skills with equal dexterity and with equal enthusiasm. So she would go see him play, hoping that would be all. My mother told me there was a certain grace and ferocity, whether he was kicking goals or kicking ass. She didn't come up with that opinion just because she was married to him. Though she might have been biased, her belief in his talent was confirmed when the Scottish national team visited Chicago for a friendly match, an exhibition game, and were impressed. In fact, after the game, members of the coaching staff spoke to him and made an informal offer for him to come to Scotland to play. He was, after all, already a citizen of the Commonwealth. My mother and father separated when I was 1.5 years old, when Celtic in Glasgow, Scotland, offered him a formal contract. My father decided to take an opportunity to do what he always wanted to do, play football full time, at the highest level against the best players. It was, for him, the chance of a lifetime, the chance to play for one of the most famous teams in the British Isles. It was an opportunity to see who he was and what he was, to avoid sliding through fits of old age and animosity and spasms of, I could have been a contender that no one believed. That sort of thing can even make you doubt yourself, doubt what you know, doubt what you would have sworn if anyone was willing to listen. To play with Celtic was also a Jackie Robinson-like invitation for him. It was something that had been beyond the reach and outside the dreams of blacks.
Context of white supremacy. That would be audio segment number one, Gil Scott-Heron, The Last Holiday. Brilliant job by the narrator. I've just been spellbound. What a rendition. Woof! If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Excuse me, 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you don't want to use your phone, you can use the free Vote line to participate. It should be linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need that address, it is tinyty.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. Address again, tinyty.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. When you put in the address, look on the left of the page. You'll see the link for the free vote line. Click it. When you do so, it'll open a small window on your screen. Top line, it's a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in real name, nickname. You can press, you know, random keys, whatever. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button. We'll connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. Same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *6. When you do so, you'll hear the audio prompt. Press the number 1. We will get you on the line. Folks who dialed in, if you would like to participate, line should be open. We ended. We're right at the end of chapter 4, so we'll pick up for the second audio segment for chapter 4. Excuse me, we ended at the end of 3, so we'll pick up on chapter 4 if anyone is following along with the book. Folks that dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to chime in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I'm looking forward to a good read. I have listened also to a lot of Mr. Heroin, and I took some notes, made 8 points on that I thought was interesting in the first read, starting with number one. I thought I heard the unique travesty of racial displacement happened to Mr. Heron's family and or the neighborhood. I thought I heard something about that earlier in the book, and it's something that took place. All over the world, and there's plenty of stories that can be talked about in just about every area where non-white black people stay, especially the larger ones. And down here in South Florida, the main place that was displaced was where black people were displaced was the section in Miami called Overtown. Number two, the piano seems to be a basic instrument of music where people who first go into music, the first thing that they do learn to do is to play the piano. It's the basis of a lot of musicians as far as for what I hear. I've even had family members that learned their first lessons in music was through the piano. Rufus and Carla Thomas, father and daughter, who were excellent singers. They ended up being on the Stax record label, became famous in that way. Mr. Thomas, before that, I believe, was a very popular DJ in the Memphis area. I have here for number four, in my opinion, blues is a foundation of music in this part of the world, period. If the only unique form of music in this part of the world also. Everything else was brought in from somewhere else, as far as what I understand. Blues is like a foundation. Number five, the Lorraine Hotel, It was frequent by a lot of quote unquote black celebrities, just like in every major city in this part of the world. There was a hotel, sometimes black owned or black employed, where black people were invited to spend the night or spend some time away from home when they are away from home. There was a place like that in just about every major city. I think I mentioned before down here in Miami, the place was called the Hampton House. They've just reconstructed it and made it out of a museum. Berry Gordy of Motown was, I believe, the person who came up with the name Stevie Wonder. Number seven, Fingertips, was his first hit, and it was at the ripe age of 12, I believe, 11 or 12, with Stevie Wonder. It was actually a live performance from what I hear. Soccer was not a popular sport in this part of the world, especially in the southern states, and especially in Chicago, as far as they're concerned. But it is the world's most popular sport. And I have that in the most popular version of football. And that's all I have for right now. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Other folks who dialed in, who have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free. Maybe they are not in an area where they can speak presently. We'll give a second and see if they want to chime in. We had a listener, she wrote in. She said, I went to Lincoln with Gil and knew him well. I attended a B.B. King concert with him, attended a class he taught, and hung out a lot with him and a couple of his band members, Brian and Bobby, who also went to Lincoln. Ultimately, we all went our separate ways after school. I did not know he wrote a book. This will be interesting. Absolutely. I think he's actually written more than one book. But this is, I think, the last, or this actually was published posthumously in 2012. But I think he actually had at least one or two books published while he was alive as well. I'll verify that during the call. Other folks, Emmy, did you have commentary you want to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Radiant Emmy.
Thank you. Greetings, everybody. I'm excited to participate in this particular book. I'm actually not very well read on many folks' biographies. So I actually don't, like, I know of Gil Scott Heron, but I don't, and I've heard a couple of songs, but I don't actually know a whole lot about him. And I guess in my entire experience with the Cows, this would be true in terms of information and people that I, like, didn't know beforehand. So I think that it's, I love the introduction. I can tell that he's definitely an artist. Like artistic and creative, artsy, not, you know, just like I'm a writer, but, you know, he's kind of artsy. But I like, the most important thing about the introduction that I like is that it's, he tells me that he's writing it to his children and other people. But I think to be writing a memoir to your children is awesome, is really nice. I think one of the things that I've been noticing too is, and learning a lot more about individuals and hearing the years, it's like a constant reinforcer of how much time really has not passed. I think to some extent, maybe I delude myself in thinking it's been a little bit more time, or it feels like it's been more time only because I've been here for a short amount of time, or the world, like technology and things have moved so much that it seems like a lot of time has passed when in fact it really hasn't. And so that participating in the books and the biographies helped me to kind of place a time context for these folks. And something that I was kind of thinking about was, like, I guess I never really paid too much attention because I got wrapped up in my own attraction to a particular philosophy or way of thinking that I didn't really pay, I'll be honest, Dr. King a lot of intensive study, research, time. I do admit that I'm a victim. So when I'm hearing how many of the famous people of that time are very much in line with, you know, that thinking, that philosophy, that way of doing things, I'm kind of like a little shocked because I guess it was a little off-centered. I just kind of thought it was a little bit different. I didn't know so much energy was going into Dr. King's birthday and things like that. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying there's anything wrong. I'm just saying I didn't know. And so I appreciate, I mean, for it to be the beginning of the text, there's quite a lot of attention on that. And also on Mr. Wonder, Mr. Stevie Wonder, a lot of things I really did not know. I didn't know that he had all of those names and beginning names and stuff like that. And to be honest, I've listened to his music. And again, it's not like I know his entire catalog. So the biography has definitely helped me to flesh out influential non-white people who I might know about, but very superficially. So I look forward to participating in the future ones. So thank you all for listening.
Indeed, for sure. We actually have done a number of biographies on whites on the Cows Book Club as well. My man, Benjamin Pitchfork Tillman, as well as the infamous Chris Kyle, American Sniper. We did that as well. But yeah, biographies are fantastic. Might even, maybe down the road, we can do LaRon Bennett Jr.'s Forced Into Glory biography on Abraham Lincoln. But another day, another book. If other folks have commentary, the other folks who dialed in with a hand up, are you able to speak now? Need more time?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hi. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to everybody else. This is The Voice from Florida. I found it to be real interesting, especially when he starts talking about the Confederacy and taking away the homes and lands. And I'm reading a book right now called White Rage by Carol Anderson, and talks a lot about that, the Homestead Act. So, you know, even up to this day, we still are, you know, trying to scarce for homes through gentrification, and that's what pretty much the last interview, live video that they had of Dr. King, and he said he was going to march up there and demand our acres and mule. And you know, it just goes to show that, you know, we've been landslided for so long. And Gil, I know through reading a little bit about him, I'm not too really in depth on Gil, but I know his artistic views, he was real powerful at how he expressed himself. And I really found that fascinated. Also with the soccer, I noticed, like, you know, being that I have family from the island, and it's real big on soccer, just like a retired firefighter stated, like globally, everybody's into soccer. So I know a lot of times the soccer players, especially the good ones, are, you know, black soccer players, and the speed that they have, especially down in, when you have the Nigerian and Jamaican soccer players, all the guys from the island pretty much were very swift. So by the only way you can really, you know, whites could really stop them is by trying to injure them on purpose. And I still see that to this day in the game, you know, the little dirtiness that they do. So I kind of understood where that was coming from. Also, the tackiness of Stevie, the blind boy. And I felt like, I don't know if anybody else felt that, but I know, like, during the early stages of history with the circus, and I just felt like they just called him out on, like, some freak circus act, and that's the vibe that I was getting. Also, I would love to see a biopic of Stevie Wonder shortly, because he's a very powerful and prominent figure, and he has connections to pretty much everything, so that would be nice. And that's all I have for right now.
Right on. Other folks, if you have commentary, feel free, chime in. We have a good bit of time before we get to the second audio segment. Mr. Gil Scott Heron, before his death, he did have quite a few books. The one we're reading now, The Last Holiday, came out in 2012. He had The Vulture, that came out in 2010. The Nigger Factory, that came out also in 2010. Now and Then. He has quite a few different books that he wrote that came out in 2000, Now and Then. Quite a few. So if you want to go and check out some of his other texts, things that he was talking about, feel free. Very talented artist. Some of the notes that I took on the text, I guess, speaking of artistry, not only does he have poems within the reading, which we've had before on the program. I'm thinking of Assata Shakur's biography. She had poems in there as well. But he also uses a lot of alliteration where you use like the same consonant sound. Like he has one where it's just lots of S's, like seashells, seashore, that sort of thing. He does a lot of that, which can make it difficult to read, but just the artistry in the way that he writes. To specific details and notes that I took, he said when he's describing how they left Jackson, Mississippi in 1962, and he said that he knew this was that this move had been coming for a long time because they were going to build a highway. Not only have we talked about this in detail on the program, how this is one of the ways that whites go about confiscating black property. Oh, we got to put, you know, a new highway here. You know, you can't, you know, have you niggers standing in the way of progress. Got to have, you know, roads and things. And so they'll, of course, have to build it through wherever the black residents happen to be. We talked about this many times. We talked about it specifically on the book club, Katrina After the Flood, where it came up where whites did the exact same thing in New Orleans, Louisiana, not that far from Jackson, Mississippi, built a highway right through the black neighborhood. It was described as an act of murder, in fact, in quotes, from Katrina After the Flood book, which I also narrated. Continuing, he says early on, I think Emmy pointed this out, where he says, this book is a chance to share some things with his children and other readers, things that he hopes will be useful. I think that was mentioned with Coretta Scott King, that she might have been with some of the sections, particularly towards the end. It might have been an opportunity to do the same thing. I don't recall if she stated that explicitly, that she was writing that book to share some things with her children, you know, type of a thing. I don't know if she said it explicitly, but I suspect that that was, you know, some of the motivation for what she was doing with her memoir as well. Let's see. The effort by Stevie Wonder, I thought as well, to get that right out, to get that right out front, and particularly for him to phrase this, he said, we all need to see folks reach beyond what looks possible and make it happen. We need more examples of how to make it happen. We will all face difficult circumstances along the way that will challenge our self-confidence and try to disrupt our decisions about the directions we wish to choose. I hope this book will remind you that you can succeed. Excuse me, I had to cough. That help can arrive from unexpected quarters at times that are crucial. And he goes on to talk about how he believes in spirits. I thought all of that and connecting that with kind of centering Stevie Wonder as being, you know, kind of the vanguard of this effort, along with Coretta Scott King, to make sure that, you know, this federal holiday is established, regardless of what one, you know, thinks about the value of such a event in replacing white supremacy with justice. But I just thought that was so important because I think that is crucial. That's something we've talked about on this program a lot over the years, about how do you inspire courage particularly in black people, under these conditions where it can look downright hopeless often, how do you inspire courage in the face of, you know, tremendous adversity? And being able to see examples, particularly see examples of black people doing things that seem impossible, to see a blind black person spearhead an effort to get a federal holiday for Dr. King, which was staunchly opposed by a number of powerful whites, and to see that happen, I could see how that could be something to inspire some black people. And certainly I can see why Gil Scott-Heron would think that's something important, why he would want to put that right at the beginning of the book. Continuing, I thought it was... at least noteworthy, where he said he calls everybody brother man. He even referenced Stevie Wonder as brother Stevie Wonder, and I chuckled to myself, knowing that is certainly not my position. But that, to me at least, that kind of makes the point. If you're calling everybody brother man, then there's nothing, you know, particularly special about you, you know, brother Gus and all that. Like, you know, if everybody is brother and sister, then it doesn't really mean anything. Continuing, when he talks about his mother and father separating when he was 1.5 years old for his father to go pursue his dream playing football, soccer as they call it. Number one, it reminded me of Fences when he gives that description about how he did not want his father didn't want to be that guy that grows old like Troy in Fences, and is bitter and resentful about being denied, you know, his opportunity that he could have been a professional athlete, and racism kept him down. And so he didn't want to miss out on that. So I totally understand. There's tons and tons and tons of black people, past, present, future, under the system of white supremacy, who are denied their potential in a myriad of different fields, way beyond athletics. Brilliant, you know, astrophysicists who are denied the opportunity to be geniuses because of white supremacy. But just, I mean, wow, like... I'm going to go play white people's ball games as opposed to being here with my 1.5-year-old child. I mean, priorities. Mr. Fuller and Renethia Tate, she's been a guest on the program repeatedly. She talks about that explicitly in her book, Pieces of a Puzzle, where she says the system of white supremacy, it really corrupts our ability to accurately assess value. Like our priorities are crazy in the system. Ball get right now, like people that are, you know, as opposed to us trying to figure out how to solve the problem of racism, white supremacy, like, oh my God, the finals, let me go see if the Warriors are going to win the championship, like to totally disrupt priorities about what is important. If there is indeed a system of white supremacy and white people are waging war against Dr. King, Gil Scott-Heron, Minister Malcolm X, Coretta Scott King, black people in general, then what should we be doing with that time and energy? What is most important? I also thought the the portion of the book where he was talking about the history that is, I guess, erased, not discussed, whitewashed, they might say, about slavery and black bondage. Also reminded me of New Orleans, came up in, I think that got discussed explicitly in Katrina After the Flood. It also reminded me of Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told, where he talks about the history of slavery and that being, you know, that was the town, like exactly what he said, whores, slavery, exactly what he said, that was New Orleans. That was the spot where you can buy a nigger wench, a high yellow nigger wench, and gamble and do the whole thing right in New Orleans, Louisiana, again, right not that far from Jackson, Mississippi. But again, and in my view, it's not that white people are ignorant about this. It's just that they do a great job of making sure that we are not well informed about this information. And we just end up being confused about racism, white supremacy in general, what it means to be white. I will pause there, see if other folks have commentary they would like to share. Folks have a hand up, or if you have commentary, number again, 641-715-3640, code 564-943-pound. Other folks, comments they would like to share, anything stood out from the first portion of the reading? Folks are, I reckon, spectating a tad today. or maybe it didn't, nothing stood out as much. Maybe we need to read a little bit more for folks to have any noteworthy things that have stood out. Mr. Demery Ford, commentary, good to hear from you, sir. Do you have any commentary you want to share?
Yes, greetings to the other callers. I was excited about participating in this particular book. Gil Scott Heron, a very conscious individual, and to me was an influence, you know, to become more socially conscious. I saw him perform in Washington, in Seattle, Washington, in the 70s. And what was phenomenal to me was that when he made his music, it was original African instruments. He wasn't using traditional, English or American type instruments. And then he talked through the session. What's in the book also was, you know, where he was born. And I noticed he mentioned a lot about his name and his ancestors or people that he descended from. And unlike some of the individuals, the conscious black individuals of that time was changing their names, he didn't change his original name. And I like the part about spirituality where he believes in a spiritual force that's guiding him, but he wasn't restricted to the basic or the traditional forms of and what people call them. He just knew that there was a force that was guiding him. And he started out unselfishly talking about Stevie Wonder when, which Stevie Wonder deserves all the accolades that he could get, because when we finished with Coretta Scott King's book, you know, the way she talked about fearlessly fighting for the holiday, you know, she did mention Stevie Wonder, but a lot of forces that were, you know, forming at that time and moving towards, you know, helping to bring about that federal holiday, you know, included a lot of individuals that we would probably never even hear about. And I'm just learning as we go. My book will be in next week, but, you know, just happy that we're doing this book and happy you took the call. Thanks.
For sure. Appreciate that, Mr. Demery Ford. Also wanted to make sure I got in a correction. It was not Jackson when he was talking about. It was Memphis, the area that he was talking about being known as the headquarters for whores and for humans sold to the highest bidder, and how that gets obscured by all the hoopla around Elvis Presley and rock and roll and Graceland and blah, 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 was Memphis. But that would be true pretty much for anywhere in the United States. Washington, D.C., same thing, where the terrorism and war against black people and how that's been waged in all different regions of this part of the world globally, that just gets minimized, obscured. That would be, you know, standard racist operating procedure. See, any other comments? The focus on Stevie Wonder being blind, it reminded me, it was, I believe, the 2014 Super Bowl. I think that's when it was, 2014 Super Bowl. They were talking, they used some metaphor or something. Something happened during the game where they were saying, maybe the ref missed something. And they said, you know, even Stevie Wonder would have seen that, or even Ray Charles would have seen that. And the point was raised. It's noteworthy because I hadn't heard this before, but people were saying that they don't ever hear a white person who is blind. You do have people who are classified as white who have, you know, who are vision impaired. You do not hear that said, like, oh my gosh, you know, what such and such, you know, whatever white, blonde, white person would have seen that. It's always Ray Charles would have seen that. Stevie Wonder would have said that. And they were just questioning, is there something racist, racial about it, the emphasis, if somebody's going to, you know, talk about somebody being blonde or not seeing something, that we're going to use a blonde black person as the example. And it just reminded me of that with the emphasis on Stevie Wonder being blind and him saying, you know, you don't hear people focus on Ray Charles and the other person that I'd never heard of before, but you don't hear people focusing on them being blind. I guess with Ray Charles, I feel like I do hear people emphasize that, you know, Ray Charles being blind. I guess I didn't hear people like have that in the official title, like blind Ray Charles, like, no. And I didn't, I mean, I wasn't alive when people were saying blind Stevie Wonder or what have you either. But, yeah, that just came to mind when he was giving that whole discussion, which I agree with, the way that Stevie Wonder was being branded. Let's see, any other folks dialed in? Any other commentary folks wanted to get in before we get to the second audio segment?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I almost forgot to mention the segment when he talks about spirituality, and I was grateful for that. I think that that makes it a nice follow-up to Ms. King's book, with something a little bit more open, but something that he's open talking about. Like, it's not a traditional thing where people have to, you know, like sex and actual religions and stuff like that, but that there's, that he talks about it. I guess it's something I think about too. So I like to have heard someone else talk about it and say, even though it might be nameless, you can't deny that it's there. So I appreciated that. That's it. Thanks.
We had a listener, a black female listener in Wisconsin. She wrote in, she said, reading this book is a real treat for me. I was introduced to Gil Scott-Heron's music only about 6 years ago. I enjoyed his music because it felt like I got to know him through his music. I did not know that he had written books, but am not surprised because he is a phenomenal storyteller. His explanation about the spirits I related to right on time because I feel too, I am guided in the same way. No religion or church to promote, but a knowing that I am being guided by something bigger. And I also... it also sounds like his grandfather was suffering from diabetes. Looking forward to continuing the reading. Indeed, indeed. Anything else folks wanted to make sure they get in before we get to second audio segment? Anything else stood out?
I was just saying about Mr. Wonder is that his music reigned, popular through at least three decades that I know of, as far as I'm talking about the latest songs that's out, that people just relish because of his musicianship and also the lyrics for at least the 60s, 70s, and the 80s for the most part, I can recall. I mean, top of the line as far as popularity and sales, as far as that concerned. And for everything that I've read and studied about him, the people that was around him would just marvel at his ability in music and in all aspects, playing different instruments, his experimentation with musical instruments, well ahead of other people, as well as his, you know, songwriting. I mean, phenomenal, you know, as far as that's concerned. And for Mr. Scott Heron to mention him is a great deal of humbleness that it could be phrased as, you know, respect. You know, big time as far as that concerned, to mention him in his book. That's just a thought of mine. Thank you.
Absolutely. I don't know if people, I guess I'm just trying, I guess if I was going to put it this way, when I've heard people mention black people that used music to discuss or address racism, white supremacy, I don't know how often Stevie Wonder's name is mentioned. Like, I'll hear Gil Scott-Heron or Marvin Gaye, or Public Enemy. I'll hear people like that, Nina Simone. Stevie Wonder should be pretty high on that list, and for a long period of time, like not one or two songs, but lots of songs that were addressing racism. I mean, we started the program today. His song for the King Holiday, and even more recent stuff. Stevie Wonder was on, I think he did the whole soundtrack for Spike Lee's Jungle Fever, Cowbell, and then he did... I think at least two songs on the soundtrack for Bamboozled, which is all about racism. And I think one of those songs is Misrepresented People, which, wow, very explicit about racism and specifically racism in TV and how black people are portrayed through racist entertainment and images and what have you. But yeah, he has done a tremendous amount of work. In fact, I even remember way back 2009 when Professor Griff, the first time that he was a guest on the program, Justice asked him that very question: can you think of artists that have made music that is constructive that children could listen to that talks about racism? And that was one of the names that Professor Griff offered, was Stevie Wonder. I would definitely co-sign on that. Anything else folks want to get to before we get to audio segment number two? Folks satisfied? Right on. If you had additional comments that you did not get in, or if you got something, jot it down. We will have additional time. The second audio segment is a little longer. It was kind of like the chapters got a little longer as you go on. As I said, we ended on chapter 3, so we're starting on chapter 4 very early in the book. So the chapters get a little longer as we proceed. So this segment is a little longer than what we would normally do, but we'll still have ample time to share. So we're picking up on chapter 4. This is Gil Scott-Heron, The Last Holiday, A Memoir, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2. 4. According to my grandmother, Lily Scott, I arrived at the house on South Cumberland Street in Jackson, Tennessee, in December of 1950. After taking the train south with her, my grandmother had come to Chicago to collect me from my mother after they agreed I would be better off in Tennessee while everything in my mother's life was restructured, like where she lived, how she lived, and, to be blunt, who she didn't live with. She and my father had agreed to disagree and were to make this difference of opinion as official as their previous agreement. I was not needed as either a referee or witness to this action and was sent on the Seminole with my mother's mother. According to the plan, I would be with her for 6 months. I was not consulted. My stay stretched beyond those 6 months that had been planned and eventually beyond 6 years, which landed me in the same school my mother had attended, St. Joseph's. The period from a skinny chocolate preschool-aged mischief maker to my short pants uniform at Catholic school seems hardly a blink in retrospect. As I grew up, I was blessed with the run of an aging neighborhood in the southern section of town where I was always near a cousin or someone who recognized me as a descendant of a family that was near legend in South Jackson. I was an heir of Bob and Lily Scott. My every appearance was a reminder of some hazy happening from the Halcyone days before Cumberland Street was even paved and before Jackson was large enough to show up on state maps. All the black folks lived in South Jackson. A substantial percentage of the community members were from my grandparents' generation. It seemed that the numbers were split between folks who were easing toward senior citizenry and those of school age. The whole was in the middle, people my mother's age. Those were the folks who had left Jackson and Tennessee for factory work and urban life in the north or farther west, St. Louis,
Memphis, and Chicago. Somehow, their children, like me, all ended up in Jackson with their grandparents, aunts, and uncles. The most popular sport in the South was baseball, and the stands for the Little League games were always fairly crowded with mature community experts. My game was somewhere between mediocre and all right, but my pitching reminded them of steel arm Bob Scott, my grandfather, who once pitched for the local team. My ripping and running in general through the dusty streets brought back stories of the four Scott children who had run and ripped 20 years before I arrived. Everyone remembered them, so Jackson felt like a town full of parents and grandparents. I was welcomed everywhere. I was identified and respected in Jackson as a Scott. Bob Scott's boy. I was identified as though the Herons did not exist. I didn't mind being connected to Bob Scott. I just didn't know him because he died the year before I was born. Under consideration, I decided that most things that were important had happened just before I was born. My grandfather, the Second World War, Jackie Robinson, the things that were important to people in church or on the front porch at night. They had gotten all their living done, and their accomplishments were strung out behind them like pearls on a leash. Lazy evening conversations would allow us all to take figurative walks through the gardens where those highlights of their lives had been planted. My grandmother had been born Lily Hamilton in Russellville, Alabama. It was an appropriate name for a delicate, fair-skinned woman with raven black hair that nearly reached the floor when she let it down to brush it. She was scarcely more than 5 feet 2 inches and never more than 110 pounds. She was a laundress. Her first job had been for the railroad, cleaning and preparing the tablecloths and place settings for the club car diners and the uniforms for the porters and conductors who worked on the rail on the 2 passenger trains that shuttled between Miami and Chicago. To facilitate that job, she had moved to Jackson, Tennessee, roughly halfway between those 2 points. Once I landed in Jackson, every summer I rode on either the Seminole or the city of Miami, back and forth to Chicago to see my mother. By the time I came to live with Lily in 1950, she was taking in laundry for a living. She did her job at the house on Cumberland Street for individual, private customers who brought their clothes to the house and picked them up a few days later. I don't know how she started doing that job or how she got her customers, but among the people she provided this service for was the mayor, though he had started bringing his clothes before he was mayor, the chief of police, though his wife and son came more often than he himself did, and the owner of a large downtown department store. I found out how she felt about quite a few things from listening to what she said to them about how much respect they had for her by the way they listened. I heard her address the chief about the problem, what wasn't right, what was bothering folks, what needed to be done. He would nod his big, bald head, and in his half-growl, he would drawl, "Oh, Lily, you know them kind of things take a while." She would always speak her mind, and it took just the right amount of time for her to finish her points and to gather their shirts and other property. But she spoke her mind wherever she was, like her evaluation of the waiting area reserved for blacks in Corinth, Mississippi, a filthy, cave-dark back room where we had to wait to change buses when we visited family back in Russellville, Alabama. She would be sure the white ticket seller heard her let loose a list of complaints. She seemed to make the other black folks in there nervous, and I got the impression that she didn't care. there were no good racists and no places where you would prefer to be discriminated against. There was no best racist state, but there may have been a worst racist state. From my brief experience, that dishonor would have to go to Mississippi. For whatever reason, I felt bad in Mississippi. I felt black and mistreated. Maybe it was because of the things I heard about Mississippi, about the murders there, about Mac Parker and Emmett Till and Medgar Evers, who were all murdered in Mississippi while I lived in Jackson. Maybe it was the size of the signs that said "colored" at the bus station in Corinth. Maybe it was the absolute stink in the bathroom of that bus station, which was unmatched in my experiences before or since. My mother and uncle used to say they hated to go to the stores in Jackson with Lily because she would embarrass them. White cashiers at uptown stores always waited on white folks first. They would never ask, "Who's next?" If somebody white walked in, they would go straight to the counter as if the black people were invisible. But not with my grandmother. She was not in sync with certain facts. There were signs indicating some of the rules, like in that Mississippi bus station with its colored waiting room. But my grandmother didn't consider it a rule for her if there was no sign. And white people had their own limits as to how far they could or would push that "us first" bullshit. So in line at the cash register, my grandmother would loudly say, "I was here before them," and hold out her money. It wasn't her stature that kept people off her. Somehow her attitude and bearing brought her respect. I would hear white folks whispering in stores in uptown Jackson when my grandmother would stand at their counters and say quite distinctly that she wanted to purchase something on credit. As a rule, colored people couldn't even ask for credit, but my grandmother did not follow rules like that. If she was speaking to a new employee, there would be a pause that hung in the air between us like a condor, not needing to wave its wings and disturb the air. The clerks would look at her. She was obviously unafraid to make eye contact with them and feel their throats tighten. They would excuse themselves to get their bosses to tell her no, but the boss would approve it and the clerks would return with silly grins, tearing their faces up while they wrote down whatever it was she wanted to buy. I could imagine the bosses saying, "That's Lily. She's Bob Scott's wife." There were regular gatherings on the front porch when the weather was warm. It could include any number of people from the neighborhood, but it always included Mrs. Cox, the school janitor's wife from across the street, and someone from the Cole family next door, as well as either Cousin Lessie or Uncle Robert. And no matter where the conversations started, they would end up speaking on race. What was happening here and there, what they had read in the papers, what information had come through from the men and women who worked on the trains and knew what was going on from Miami to Chicago. I remember hearing about Emmett Till and Mac Parker on the front porch. A 12-year-old and a truck driver both murdered by white people. Mac Parker was lynched and Emmett Till was beaten to death. Inevitably, someone would bring up possible solutions, something that could stop folks from getting killed that way. The most frequent conclusion was that some organization, perhaps the NAACP, needed to do something. My grandmother was rarely too talkative on those occasions. She would talk when she had something to say and laugh a lot at the things the excitable Mrs. Cox would say. What directed blacks in Jackson was their belief in the Baptist Church. We attended Berrien Baptist Church every Sunday. My grandmother did not like a lot of people. She wasn't one to be doing a lot of laughing it up with strangers. She was friendly with the church people and participated in all of their various to-dos. When she was in Russellville with Uncle Council, or when her children were home for a while, she was visibly happy. But Lily Scott did not like people for no reason. She was not stuck up or snooty or snobbish. She was not narrow-minded, naive, neurotic, nosy, or negative. She was not combative, complaining, compulsive, or complacent. You could count on her. She was predictable, patient, perceptive, persistent, proud, private, and practical. She had a healthy respect for hard work and was not afraid to put in her time. She was a sane, sensible, settled, serious, solid, single-minded survivor. And she was a religious and God-fearing woman with high ideals, strong principles, and most of all, a belief in the power of learning. Though she did not have a lot of formal book learning herself, she had insisted that her children be educated. And she had scraped, scrimped, scrambled, scrunched, scrubbed, scratched, scuffled, slaved, and saved until somehow all four of her children had graduated from college with honors. She read to me and taught me to read very early. At 4 years old, we were reading the funny papers on Sunday and a few chapters from the Bible each night. On Thursdays, there was a man who delivered the Chicago Defender, the black weekly paper. It was in the Defender that I first read columns by Jesse B. Semple, including his conversations with Langston Hughes. His column became the first thing I would look for. I cannot remember too many Bible specifics after Exodus, but I do know the Old Testament had a lot of long names to pronounce, and that taught me phonetics. The front porches of the black folks in Jackson were where everyone sat in the cool of the early evening, and people always threw invitations our way if we walked by. But my grandmother rarely stopped. We would wave to folks we knew, naturally, and I would often hear, "That's Bob Scott's boy, and Lily. Good man, Bob Scott." I never understood how they always skipped over my father to attach me to my grandfather, but I didn't mind or say anything because I knew my grandmother could hear them and she never turned around. 5. My grandmother would sometimes talk about her life back in Russellville, Alabama, before she moved to Jackson. She had several brothers and sisters, though I remember only two of her brothers. She would take me to see them in Alabama. She always noted the steady consistency of her brothers, how dependable they were, and how well they served as the decision makers for her generation. We stayed with Uncle Buddy, whose name was Morgan, after their father. He was the oldest and head of the family, a sober elder statesman who never said four words when three would get it said. There was also Uncle Council, a short, wiry, fast-talking man with a quick wit and dozens of new stories to tell. The Hamiltons, my grandmother's family, were almost white people. The father of my grandmother and her brothers had been a white man who evidently could not marry their black mother because they were in Alabama. Apparently, he spent most of his day in the large house at the front of the property where Uncle Buddy now lived, and then came to join his family at the back in the evening. I don't remember ever seeing a picture of him or them from what would have been the early 1900s, but they were all named Hamilton and collectively made decisions about how the farm and livestock would be handled. The Hamiltons came in two distinctive sizes. There was the small economy size of my grandmother with her energetic work ethic that carried her around the house and the yard from can see to can't see,
sweeping, dusting, digging around the flowers and the pomegranate bush, Uncle Council was her size and had the same type of irrepressible energy. Uncle Buddy represented the other size, extra large, and was always a comfort when he was near this huge person in faded overalls and a sun-shielding hat. He represented stability, reliability, and security, and his size implied strength of both physique and character. It was darker than a thousand midnights just outside the bedroom window at Uncle Buddy's place in Russellville, but I knew he was around and I never had any trouble sleeping there. It was always Uncle Buddy with his long, calm face and thoughtful eyes who met us at the bus station in Tuscumbia, or less often met the train at Red Bay, Alabama. There was no direct anything to Russellville. My grandmother and I would crawl into the northwest corner of Alabama on a gas-choked, dusty greyhound or a near-lifeless locomotive. A trip of less than 150 miles took the better part of a day before breaking at this cluster of clapboards or solitary shacks as though we had arrived somewhere. As always, Uncle Buddy would come shuffling up with a welcoming grin for his sister and a nod for me. That was one of his speeches, that nod. After a long description of something by Uncle Council, he would nod his head and smile. After an agreement was reached about things the family needed to have done, he would nod that it would be done. He could have been known as the Nod Father. One of the more interesting stories I heard about the type of stock I came from concerned Uncle Buddy. One day he was down the path in the backyard while the rest of the family was gathered on the back porch. All of a sudden, Buddy appeared holding his hand over his eye. When he got up close and moved his hand, the people on the porch could see that a bumblebee had stung him and left the stinger in the white of his eye. My grandmother said that everybody was screaming except Buddy. They helped him sit down, and Lily removed the stinger with a pair of tweezers. When she finally had it, they gave him a damp cloth, and he got up and said, "Thank you. I appreciate that." Then he went on back to whatever he'd been doing in the yard. I used to think that under the word stoic in the dictionary, there would be a picture of Uncle Buddy. But stoic isn't right because it doesn't incorporate Uncle Buddy's smile and kind eyes. And having a bee stinger in your eye and saying nothing until you thank the person who removes it goes beyond stoicism. It's a wonder he didn't just nod. I always enjoyed myself at Uncle Council's house, where we went for meals sometimes. He had children near my age, and I could play with them. The meals were always great, with a lot of family members around the table and recollections by Uncle Council that kept everyone laughing. The Hamilton family was close, and I never felt left out of anything because of my grandmother's love, and the love they all felt for her was partly mine. Back in Jackson, we had family around too. The Scott House on South Cumberland was the second from the corner of Tanyard Street. Make a left on Tanyard, and the third house was where Miss Emmeline Miles lived. I called Miss Emmeline Aunt Sissy, and while there were a lot of folks identified like relatives in the South, like Cousin Lessie or Uncle Robert next door to us, Aunt Sissy was really my aunt. In fact, great aunt. She was Bob Scott's sister. I didn't always understand Aunt Sissy and the way she would hug me and call on African spirits. She would surprise me on her porch with fierce, emotional, smothering embraces and would run her bony fingers up and down my spine as she held me.
She was also a virtual river of information that I could have used to find out more about the man I got half of my name from, Bob Scott. But I was too young to know to ask. Everybody who talked about Bob Scott for any length of time brought up his love of sports. This alone was enough to make him my favorite relative, especially among the Scott men. My mother had a photograph in an album, a posed black and white family portrait that was taken in the late 1930s or early 1940s. It was the entire Scott family, three teenaged girls in Sunday dresses, a fresh-faced boy in a suit jacket and a white shirt with no tie, and a short, fair-skinned lady with long, dark hair. They were standing in a half circle around a well-dressed gentleman who sat at an angle. It was the only picture I'd ever seen of the man, Bob Scott, who was obviously tense at the center of the semicircle, holding a cane with large, strong hands, searching for the camera with sightless eyes. I was struck by how tall Bob Scott was. Reaching his wife's shoulder level while seated, I could also see two things I was looking for in him right away. First, the athlete, Steel Arm Bob, the pitcher who bested Satchel Paige. The second thing was Aunt Sissy. I was looking for the family resemblance between him and his sister, and it was right out front. The tall, raw-boned physique, the African cheekbones, the bushy hair and eyebrows, the sad eyes. It was all there. Because of Aunt Sissy and the other older people in South Jackson, I was looking for myself in that old portrait, too. I was looking for what they saw when I passed by, and they said, "That's Bob Scott's boy. Good man, Bob Scott." I was looking for what made Aunt Sissy hug me and call me her only blood relative when I dropped in after running an errand for her, for what made her say we had royal African blood in our veins, why she would invent words for illness that were allegedly attacking her, like the epizootic, something that afflicted only special people, people like us. He was a gentleman and a gentle man. My grandmother told me about her husband. It was as nice a summary as I was likely to get. It told me something about the two of them that corresponded to things I had been told and overheard. Daddy never whipped us, my mother told me on a visit to Jackson. But Mama did. He would even try to talk her out of it. "He never whipped any of you?" I asked. "No. You see, he said that no Scott man would hit a woman or a child, that having to resort to that would mean he had lost control of his home and he would have to leave." Maybe she sensed what I was wondering. "Daddy was the insurance man," she added, "during the real depression, when everybody was depressed." I knew an insurance man in Jackson. His name was Mr. Fuller, and he came around once a week, though sometimes it seemed like every day. He was a middle-aged, balding gentleman who was always sweating and wiping his face and head with a handkerchief. He stood in the living room, thumbing through his receipt book, waiting for my grandmother and sweating. And as he wiped his face, he would peek to see whether I was looking at him. I was. Mr. Fuller seemed ill at ease, but he was duty-bound to collect that little bit of change every week. "Sometimes people didn't have it," my mother continued. "It was just small change, but they didn't have it. But during those times, with money being so short, you needed your insurance more than ever, because you couldn't just skip a week and not be protected for that week. You would lose all your money, your policy, and your investment to that point." He was a tall, big-boned man with brown skin that had red undertones like an Indian and a wide open face with a large nose, solid, honest, thoughtful. By the time I was 8 or so, I could cross large streets and run errands. I went over to Aunt Sissy's every day. There were few disruptions to the quiet, organized life my grandmother and I lived, and one of the only people or things that could really get under Lily's skin was Sissy. She was too playful and unlike a 60-year-old for my grandmother, who wanted Sissy to act her age. But hell, sometimes Lily Scott wanted me to act her age. Somehow, Sissy's irreverence and disregard for quiet sanity irritated Lily. Sissy probably thought her sister-in-law took herself too seriously. I would return with a daily medical report, typically encompassing some new sickness I had never heard of. Of course, Aunt Sissy was entirely too knowledgeable to be any kind of serious about made-up African illnesses. She was a retired nurse. And anyway, Sissy was always up and tottering around in her room, an especially tall, bony, chocolate lady with a round face, a pleasant smile, and a head of gray hair cut close. Whether or not she needed me to run any errands, she would fumble around in her little purse for a couple of pennies for me for candy. She shared her house with a short, silent woman named Miss Ora Boyd, and occasionally they would both sit on their porch in the early evening, though they didn't seem to communicate with each other much. If I went by after dinner, Sissy was immediately animated, always ready for a conversation. "How come Aunt Sissy doesn't have children?" I asked my grandmother once. Sissy was married, my grandmother said, and she had a son named Jimmy Doe who died.
"From what?"
"He had a very badly curved spine. It made him look like a hunchback, and it got worse as he got older until his spine pressed in on his heart and killed him." I tried to organize a picture of that in my mind and failed.
"What is it? How do you get it?"
"It's called scoliosis. It's a curvature of the spine, a lateral curve. Sissy had a less disfiguring case of it."
"Aunt Sissy got the epizootic?" I reported confidently. "From Africa? She said we come from Africa, me and her."
"Do we?" "She came from Memphis and you came from Chicago," said my grandmother. She sounded exasperated the way she often did when Aunt Sissy was the subject. I thought it over quietly.
"The epizootic won't kill you, right?"
"Scotty, nothing will kill you if there's no such thing. I've heard all that foolishness from Sissy about what she's got, and you know what it is? Nothing. That's what. Nothing."
"You don't only get what you want from your ancestors, or you get everything from your ancestors."
I didn't know, as a child, that I had scoliosis, and that it was something that would be a problem for me all my life, tilting me to the left like a 6-foot curiosity of Italian architecture. I found out years later when I was given a physical in high school. But Aunt Sissy, running her bony fingers up and down my spine, was not searching for our African ancestors. She was looking for Jimmy Doe, and happy he wasn't there.
6. I am very proud of the education I collected through 17 years and 10 institutions from Southtown in Jackson, Tennessee, to Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. The easiest way to describe the total experience would be different. Had it been a career I was describing,
the word checkered might have come to mind, even though that word reminds me of an old taxicab company rather than what I'm trying to say. Black, white, black, white. An extensive journey that covered all the educational possibilities, including being taught at home. Because that's where my education began, in the center room of the house on Cumberland Street at Lily Scott's side. That is where I learned to read and count, and where I acquired my respect for education. From a woman with only a little. Maybe the whole black, white thing would be no more descriptive than saying, like a nun rolling down a hill. But it worked out. From a black and then a white school in Tennessee to the same things in New York high schools and through college, the alternating stops held true. And it all began with a black, white school. Black children taught by white folks in Jackson. My grandmother took me over to St. Joseph's the day I turned 5. Me and my grandmother, our short legs pumping purposefully, wearing some semi-Sunday clothes down 2 blocks on Tanyard Street and past the projects to 3-story haunted brick residence of funny-looking clothes horses, employees and confidants of white folks' God, represented, it seemed to me, by a penguin, it was my first look at a nun. The white folks refused to let me in. I was finally admitted when I was confessing my true age of 5 1/2. The school was in a dilapidated, tenement-feeling building, purgatory for the few nuns and the red-faced priest sentenced to work there. It was a creepy damn place, and it provided an eerie and frightful voyage through shadow-cloaked hallways filled with an eternity of God-fearing intimidation for young black kids like me imprisoned there. The proof of the school's physical condition gained validity after my 2nd year, when it was closed and the building condemned. Whether God himself actually lived there somewhere, I could not decide initially. I did, however, determine that in spite of the youthful appearance of these nun women in dust-dragging black, they had been around St. Joseph's for years and remembered my grandmother and her children, and it turned out they had refused me until I was 5 1/2 on purpose. They didn't let me in because my grandmother wasn't afraid of white folks. So I was punished and made to feel uncomfortable. There were lots of myths that other black kids built up about Catholic school, like how they would wash your mouth out with soap. But I never saw any of that. In fact, I don't remember getting a whipping until I got to public school 2 years later. The classrooms were upstairs above the church part, which was on the ground floor. They held mass every morning before classes. If you were late for mass, you were considered late for school. We studied the catechism. It was all taught by rote, so I could probably still recite the prayers. You remember them just like the Pledge of Allegiance. Even if you didn't know what you were saying, it was understood that God was listening. I decided I couldn't be a Catholic, at least not right then. There were too many fucking rules and regulations about where to stand, where to sit, and when. At morning mass, it was standing, sitting, kneeling, wheeling, dealing, silent on prompts from occasional mumbling from the altar. Fooey. The weird thing was what it did to the kids, how uptight and un-all right it made us, and that too became a life lesson about allegiance that I came to recognize as such. I had my introduction to the tattle at St. Joseph's, the rollover, and we were learning to do those things to ourselves for others who were not. One early spring morning, I found an old rusty knife on my way to school. Later on, someone told me it was a Swiss Army knife, but that morning it was just a short, fat object of total fascination. As I crossed a corner of the grass part of the walk in front of Liberty Street Church, my foot touched it, dislodged it, and when I bent over to see what it was, I could not believe my good luck. It had been white at some point, a pearl or oyster color, and man, was it cool. It had three or four different sized blades, a corkscrew for a very short cork, a bottle opener, a whittling blade, and parts so glazed over with rust that I couldn't pull them out. I was thinking about how I would remove the rust when I got home. I got lost examining the wonders of my discovery, continuing on a path that my feet knew by heart. At the end of Tanyard Street, take a right to walk past the projects. Until about a block from St. Joseph's, I was still so intrigued by my find that I hardly noticed Anne Morris. She was a classmate, but not someone I knew that well. She was already growing in her two permanent front teeth and reminded me of Bugs Bunny. But today, this morning, anyone was a good friend because I needed to show someone my knife. So I showed Anne Morris as we walked through the gate and up the front steps of the school, and I dropped my prize into my coat pocket. By lunchtime, it was forgotten, and after lunch during recess, when a whole posse of first through fourth graders ran after each other and from one another in dizzying, purposeless circles, I felt and became aware of, without any actual signal, a change in the tenor of the game playing and each other chasing. When I turned to check out what was going on, I saw a gathering, a ragged huddle of small black and brown faces turned upward to the chalk white face that seemed stuck halfway through the habitual cowl, scowling down earnestly. In the midst of this forming circle was Anne Morris and the subject of her earnest speech. They were coming my way. All of them, with Anne Morris appearing even smaller and shrinking next to Sister, whatever her name was, holding her hand. I don't really remember how the interrogation began, but it had been about Anne Morris telling the woman that I had a knife, making it sound like a machete, and me a midget Zorro. I said I didn't have one, that I'd thrown it away, and then Charles Dawson, on orders from the Penguin, was designated to rummage through my pockets until, beneath a tissue and two gum wrappers, in the coat lining, I felt a wave of religious irony then. When you needed help, you called for God. When you got it, you thanked Jesus. When you didn't get it, you cursed God. But I didn't. I cursed Anne Morris and Charles Dawson and Sister whatever her name was, who used this trauma of the search and discovery incident after my denial as a God-sent lesson that, one, thou shalt not lie because, two, God will be sure thou are caught, and, three, you will be punished. Sister, whatever her name was, took charge of three, and to illustrate it, I was sentenced to stand up against the fence every day during recess. And I hadn't reached 7 years old at the time, but every day during recess, I felt like I was 1,000 years old. I did get several positive things out of St. Joseph's.
For one thing, I got an education that was good enough for me to be skipped a grade when I got to public school. I did the third and fourth grades in 1 year. And for another, I got to make my debut as a vocalist in the second grade at St. Joseph's during one of the many talent shows. I did an unaccompanied version of Jamaica Farewell by Harry Belafonte. It was number one at the time. Down the way where the nights are gay. Hell, it was a hit.
And that is where we will conclude for this week. Harry Belafonte, prominently mentioned during Coretta Scott King's My Life, My Love, My Legacy. Also, President Barack Obama's Dreams from My Father, another biography that we read on the Cows way, 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 way back. If you would like to participate, the number to dial 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We should have ample time if folks have commentary they would like to get in. Try and get the people that we did not hear from the first time around. The caller 8944. I don't think we heard from you first time around. Did you have commentary you wanted to share? Caller, last four digits, 8944. Did you have commentary, or are you just listening in?
Oh, I was just listening in. I didn't have any comments.
Right on. Thank you for listening, sir. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up, if you have commentary you want to share, line should be open. Feel free.
Oh, this is for anybody?
Oh, yes, sir.
Oh, okay. I go ahead and I took down seven notes. Number one, I think it was kind of a common arrangement of a parent to have to go far away from their child or children during that time to be able to financially do the best for themselves and perhaps their child or children. That wasn't uncommon. I can recall reading about Jim Brown's mother having to go to upstate New York from Georgia, where he was born at. So it's something that was pretty common, especially during that time, which is under the system of race and white privilege, is understandable. That's a reaction, basically it's a reaction to how race and white supremacy is so well deviantly organized that is going to make non-white people have to make those type of sacrifices and in turn really compromise the family unit or units. I have here there was a part in the last reading where I believe it was talking about how some of the quote-unquote menial jobs that black people had, it would be considered to be menial jobs nowadays, but they were in positions to be able to dialogue with a powerful white person. I remember Malcolm X talking about the same thing about the bootblack downtown who would be able to dialogue with some important, perhaps powerful white person in the downtown area. Because otherwise, with black males are concerned, it wasn't a whole lot of people able to obtain employment in such places that were that close in proximity to white people, unless they was, you know, doing their clothes or something like that, or cleaning their house of some type. Number three, there's always someone who did not follow the white rules of engagement as far as how we're supposed to behave. And I guess that person that we're reading about now is his grandmother, I believe, that didn't have any fear of white people, you know, as far as, you know, just breaking those rules left and right. There was plenty of them that most black people automatically abided by getting off the sidewalk. I can recall my mother telling me about that in the places in Georgia where she grew up at, you know, getting off the sidewalk, not looking a white person in the eye, you know, speaking on a lateral basis with a white person, that sort of thing. And apparently his grandmother was that person. And I'm pretty sure that she was a deep influence on him, that we will find that out later on in the book. It was somebody else that he was talking about, some relative he was talking about that had a similar code to a counter-racist code. I forget exactly who he was talking about, but that's what it reminded me of early in the reading. He was mentioning about someone who did not have a quote unquote extensive a minimum level of education, a formal education, but yet she was inspired to make sure that her children had that background, and that's very similar to my background with my mother, who managed to, I believe, only go through maybe the second or third grade and was forced to have to stop going to school. But she made sure that her five children, and I'm by far the toughest one that she had to deal with, to go through school, even to college. Number six, he mentioned about some relative that had a code about no hitting. Very, very, very constructive, especially on how he phrased it. When he mentioned about if I go to that level, then it was something. If something had to do with respecting females, I forgot exactly what it was, but it was important enough for me to write it down. And last but not least, he had amazing memory for a lot of relatives. I mean, I was sitting there trying to think about some of the people that have been in my life, and I would not be able to mention that many people especially by names. And I'm pretty sure he's probably not even finished, you know, with it. We just starting to read the book, but I thought that was very interesting to be able to have that kind of memory for so many people, which is not unusual for Southern families, non-white black families in the Southern part of the Northwestern Hemisphere. It's not unusual. He remembered names and everything, you know. I find that amazing. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. That was his grandmother
Lily Scott, who is the one who didn't have very much education herself, blame whites for that. But she really stressed the importance of education with the rest of her family members, including Gil Scott. And then it was his grandfather was the one who didn't do any hitting. It was, make sure I'm getting it correct here. Yes, it was his grandfather who didn't do any hitting. He says that his mom was telling him, "Daddy never whipped us. My mother told me on a visit to Jackson, but Mama did. He would even try to talk her out of it. He never whipped any of you. I asked, no. You see, he said that no Scott man would hit a woman or a child, that having to resort to that would mean he had lost control of his home and he would have to leave." The part you were talking about, having that code about not hitting, that was his grandmother via what his mom had to say.
Great philosophy. Great.
For sure. Other folks have commentary that they wanted to get in. If you have a hand up, line should be open. Any other comments, folks? Nothing stood out from the second section?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm very grateful for the description of Miss Lily. I think there aren't many dynamic, and maybe, I don't know, before I even say that, it's just nice to hear about a woman held in much regard and respect who was not the typical kind of, like, sweet, nice image of, you know, female. And that, you know, it was emphasized that she was serious and that she didn't like people. But, because a lot of times that, you know, that's not welcomed if you're a female at all. If you're not, you know, extra nurturing and sweet and warm and kind and all that extra stuff. So I really appreciated that. And, just placing it in context, in terms of time as well. And I guess, I don't know, I think maybe this might be true for other people, maybe just myself, but if those, like, to use a metaphor, waves of kind of, you're like shock a little bit, like it hits me very strongly, like what it means to be black and what it means to be white. And, you know, to think about such a degraded space where, these acts of "I was here first" is a very big act, and in itself, like, revolutionary. The fact that's where we're at, that's what it is. I don't know. Sometimes it's like I get it, and then I kind of forget, or something happens, and it doesn't feel the same. And then I'll hear something like that, and then I have to remember, not too long ago, these things are commonplace. This is the same land where these things are commonplace. These are the same white people, you know. And so hearing that about her and that she was serious, it would have been fantastic to hear some of these women speak, particularly the grandmothers. But yeah, so I appreciate that because I know that it's recent, you know, Stevie Wonder, but then he's talking about his grandma. So it helps me to see that it's really not that long ago. Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate that, Emmy. Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up that we have not heard from, or just period, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary you want to share, feel free. Line should be open.
Yes, I have heard.
Yes, sir.
Okay, what stood out to me, he mentioned, you know, you can't choose what you inherit from your ancestors. So, in his case, it was curvature of the spine, but in a lot of non-white, especially black people, it's diabetes and high blood pressure and other diseases that were exacerbated or brought on by the system of white supremacy that's passed on through black generations. And also, he mentioned one of his relatives, maybe his great-grandfather, was a white man. It's hardly any of us that can say that we can trace our lineage back all the way to Africa without running into some white race soldier or terrorist that probably terrorized our grandmothers. And the education part, you know, was big. I think it's probably horrendous to go to a Catholic school to be a little black boy going to a Catholic school. And when he found the little pocket knife, and it seems that the punishment was somewhat severe for just an incident where you found a pocket knife. It wasn't like you brought it to school to with a hit list on how many people he was going to stab, you know, but it just goes to show you the punishment that's exacted on black youth by these white teachers. A lot of times they're in excess suspensions nowadays, unwanted. And we can, it's not one book that we read that don't mention, you know, about where black people live. You go in some restroom or somehow filthy it is. And, you know, part of that would have been a lot of times when it was colored only or white only, then the sanitation or health or cleanup was neglected on the side of the colored only. And the white-only side would generally be clean. And I've heard cases of black people just intentionally using the white-only side because it's just, it was just unbearable, the color-only. So we start to see the influences, you know, on Gil Scott-Heron's life, the racism, the tension, and it's important that we talk to the youth and tell them, because he was exposed through that, the extended family and then the relationships that he had with different family and black self-respect and his grandmother. And a lot of times, like we saw in Maya Angelou's book, the grandmother may have had some type of relationship with the townspeople in some type of way. Her grandmother had loaned money to white people and they owed her favors. Or if you were an upstanding person that always paid your debts and was a person of, you know, they considered trustworthy, then they would extend credit to us. It's almost ridiculous to think that black people was not extended credit during that time. But although now we extend the credit and we are levied with a so-called black tax where you pay a high interest rate on any loans that you might get today, but you know, at least you can get the loan. I'll move my line. Thanks for taking the call.
For sure, Mr. Demery Ford. Other folks who dialed in, other folks have commentary they wanted to get on what we heard, second audio segment. Folks satisfied thus far? I'll get in some of my commentary. Our listener in Wisconsin, she wrote in again. She says, reading is more important than watching television. Amen. I thought of Dr. Welsing when Gil spoke about being taught to read at an early age by his grandmother. His uncle Council was likely an influence on him
Being a storyteller, he was described as having dozens of new stories to tell. Good observation. One of the things that might have been passed on. Some of the notes that I took, let's see. Make sure I back up. Okay, from chapter 4. Let's see, where she's talking about this mass exodus from Jackson to Tennessee and Memphis, Chicago, St. Louis, all these other places. The Warmth of Other Suns, one of my top five all-time favorites, Isabel Wilkerson, the lovely Isabel Wilkerson. That is her book exactly, and she mentions some of those specific cities prominently in the text. In fact, I think one of the main characters, they did that exact trek, the Mississippi to Chicago. She talks about that. That was one of the popular main lines. No coincidence, Emmett Till was doing the reverse, going from Chicago back down to Mississippi. But that was, you know, really, really popular way that black people tried as best they could to escape white terrorism. Let's see. The next one, where he says the black people, when he was growing up, they had all got all their living done and their accomplishments were strung out behind them like pearls on a leash. Where he says it sounded like all the really important things had happened before he was born. It seemed like that was his impression as a child. And he said evening conversations would allow us all to take figurative walks through the gardens where those highlights of their lives had been planted. And when I heard that, I just, you know, we're in a system of racism, white supremacy. And I mean, you're talking this era, like 1950s, like, whoa, before the assassination of Dr. King, like, wow. And I mean, either one, if we're in Jackson, Mississippi, or after the move in Tennessee, like, what exactly would those accomplishments have been for the black people in Jackson, Mississippi, under a system of white supremacy at that time period? That was a question that came to mind. Continuing all the detail, I think Emmy and others talked about, they appreciated the detail about grandmother Lily Hamilton Scott. I thought it was interesting that he says she was delicate. She was a delicate, fair-skinned woman with raven black hair that nearly reached the floor when she let it down to brush it. Very interesting, particularly when he, you know, after this physical description of her, right, gives a description about, you know, her conduct, that she would speak her mind, you know, even though she was small, 5 feet 2 inches, and, you know, barely ever more than 110 pounds, that, you know, she would speak up, she would let you know what she thought, and she would even, you know, question white people, or tell white people what was going down, or what she thought, the white people that she did, if she did their laundry, or she went in the store, or what have you. At least in my mind, it's mightily significant that she is pale, lacking melanin. Again, remind folks, Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. in The Word Guy, he suggests that non-white people refrain from using the term fair, certainly not describing someone as being fair-skinned. To me, and again, the way I process it, it's almost like, because she is quote-unquote fair-skinned, white people will be more fair with her. They will allow her to talk back. They will allow her to go up to the store and, you know, buy things on credit and have the white people go and get her orders and not have other individuals classified as white come and, you know, just shove her to the back of the line and get their things first. They would permit her to do these things because she had less melanin. At least in my mind, that seems to be a part of, you know, what's happening here. I could be in error. I feel like I've heard that before in the system of racism, white supremacy. And even it came to mind when he said, you know, his grandmother, Lily Scott, she was standing. I mean, hey, that's black self-respect. I'm not, you know, talking bad about her. I'm just pointing out something that I think could be a contributing variable. But with her, you know, speaking up and challenging these white people, he said it a couple times. He said that his mom, Gil Scott-Heron, his mom and uncle, they hated going to the stores because they didn't like
putting up with, you know, the racist abuse from the white store clerks and what have you. And they didn't like going with his grandmother either, Lily Scott, because they didn't want to be embarrassed when she was calling out the white people and not doing all this. Even with that, and like I said, he mentioned other people also saying that, you know, his grandmother made them nervous, you know, when she was doing that sort of thing. That if I'm with her, right, they see us together. This nigga over here is with this, you know, high yellow, highfalutin nigger in here, you know, uppity telling us what to do. They see you together. You come back next time. You're not with her. Now, how do they treat you? Is it, oh, yeah, we remember you last week with all that uppiness. Nigga, you get in. Matter of fact, it might even just be more than just get out of our store. That's something that came to mind as well. Maybe not. Maybe what I'm saying doesn't make sense. Folks can share that as well. Some of the other things, let's see, that stood out from chapter 4. The laundry, I thought that was a great point that retired firefighter brought up about having these jobs. She has her cottage industry with the laundry thing, and she can talk to all these prominent members of the town. They'll come by and drop their laundry off, and she can, you know, tell them, oh, the street needs this, street needs that. Great. Outstanding. Also came to mind, I can see how white people would be comfortable with that sort of arrangement. Very plantation. It reminds me of the Help, that sort of setup. We'll have, we go to the local black woman. She does our black female. She does our, you know, cleaning for us. She's great. Okay, I could see white person in Mississippi, Alabama, someplace like that, having that sort of view. Let's see. Next. Where he says, he's talking about his grandmother speaking her mind and what have you, and he talks about the bathrooms. I was even quickly reminded of the scene from the Boondocks where they portray that. I think it was season 4, where they have the Freedom Ride episode that's kind of doing a animation of the Freedom Rides, and he, Huey's grandfather, he goes in the bathroom and he can't even stand. And this is, I think, in Alabama or Mississippi, where it is, one of the states. But he has to run out immediately. Exactly what's described is terrible. They don't clean it. And the white bathroom is, you know, taken care of, cleaned regularly. So you can use that one freely. But where he says there was no best racist state, but there may have been a worst racist state from my brief experiences. That dishonor would have to go to Mississippi. For whatever reason, I felt bad in Mississippi. I felt black and mistreated. Wow. What a sentence to me. Right, direct to the point. Not I'm black and I'm proud. Not I'm, you know, black king, queen, royalty. I felt black and mistreated. Period. Wow. Reminded me of some of Emmy's remarks as well. When he's and he follows that, right? He goes and he says, evidencing black mistreatment, Mac Parker, Emmett Till, Medgar Evers, all of these different black people who were murdered, victims of white terrorism at various different times throughout the long, bloody history in Mississippi, reminded me so much of right now, just, you know, on a larger scale, where people just, you know, every other week it's a new hashtag with a name of a black person that has been killed or tased or choked or, you know, whatever it is, feeling black and mistreated. That is the system of racism, white supremacy worldwide. Already mentioned the part about Lily embarrassing them. Let's see. Yeah, just what I said when he says he remembers hearing about Emmett Till and Mac Parker on the front porch, a 12-year-old and a truck driver both murdered by white people. Mac Parker was lynched. Emmett Till was beaten to death. Inevitably, someone would bring up possible solutions, something that could stop folks from getting killed that way. The most frequent conclusion was that some organization, perhaps the NAACP, needed to do something. My grandmother was rarely too talkative on those occasions. That whole section stood out. It just reminded me so much of exactly the same thing that you hear right now after, you know, Sandra Bland, Michael Brown, Terrence Crutcher, you know, insert name. After one of these cases, somebody's got to do something. We can't do this anymore. We're not going to take this anymore. Somebody's got to do something about these police and stand up for black people. And what does the NAACP, I guess now it'd be, you know, they're coons and Sambos and they're not going to get the job. And that same conversation, and I guess we'll continue to keep having those same types of conversations until we replace the system of white supremacy with justice. I would hope that would be the major thing. I think Emmy made that point, and that has come up repeatedly. The books that we've read over the years, particularly when we've read books that are talking about, you know, past times, you know, things that happened 50 years ago, 70 years ago, 100 years ago, and it sounds like they could be talking about something that happened 5 minutes ago, like really emphasizing, like, all this talk about progress and we've moved and, man, things are so much better. It is amazing how many things are remarkably stagnant in the system, painfully stagnant in the system of racism, white supremacy, especially with regards to feeling black and mistreated. Let's see. He mentions the Chicago Defender, the black weekly paper. This is the end of chapter four. It was in the Defender that I first read columns by Jesse B. Simple, including his conversations with Langston Hughes. His column became the first thing I would look for. I cannot remember too many Bible specifics after Exodus, but I do know the Old Testament had a lot of long names to pronounce that taught me phonetics. Reading is more important than watching TV. And the importance of black journalism, that's popped up repeatedly over the years. I try to emphasize that in black people taking charge of reporting and things that are happening to us that are valuable information that black people should know about. I did do a little digging while we were reading to see who this Jesse B. Simple character pseudonym was, and it seems this was a bit that Langston Hughes did, this character that he made up. They have a great piece online that you can read if you are so interested, titled Jesse B. Simple and the Narrative of Langston Hughes. This came out in January of 1973. I'm not going to read the whole article, but it seems a lot of these skits, and again, this is just a character that Langston Hughes made up, also a poet, but a lot of these skits were about racism. And so this one piece from this journal article that reads, this one quick paragraph, the serio-comic nature of Jesse B. Simple's wit, as well as the black idiom in which it is expressed, is an immediate locus of identification for the black reader who knows that without mother wit, which Simple has in abundance, life in America would be unbearable, black and mistreated. Imagine the laughter of the black reader when the white census taker, in all seriousness, writes down that Simple is here in spite of all, but that he expects to die by uglying away. Or the response to Simple's in-group explanation of the color question, where was us Negroes when the Lord said, let there be light? Late as usual, old CP time. We must have been down the road a piece and did not get back on time. And black readers undoubtedly recognize in Simple's complaint, catalog a slice of black life. I've been fired, and this is all in quotes from the column, Jesse B. Simple, authored by Langston Hughes. I've been fired, laid off, and last week given an indefinite vacation, also Jim Crowed, segregated, barred out, insulted, called black, yellow, and red, locked in, locked out, locked up, also left holding the bag. I have been caught in the rain, caught in the raids, caught short with my rent, and caught with another man's wife, but I'm still here. My mama should have named me Job instead of Jess Simple. I have been underfed, underpaid, undernourished, and everything but undertaken. In this life, I have been abused, confused, misused, accused, false arrested, tried, sentenced, paroled, blackjacked, beat third degree, and near lynched. Final fear, Jesse B. Simple speaks his mind. I'll even give you the last little segment. Inherent in Langston Hughes' philosophy throughout all of his works is his recognition of and pride in the fact that Afro-American has developed or perhaps had innately the ability to endure not only all of the sorrows to which man is heir, but also all of the racial calamities devised by white society to define its black citizens, to be black and mistreated. I think a lot, just this section right here, and particularly the way that Langston Hughes wrote his humor, This reminds me of Gil Scott Heron's writing a bit now. If what he wrote is true, that he used to read immediately, he said the first column he would look for was just be simple. If that is true, I see some of the influence in the way that he writes at times, with some of the rhythm in his writing, with some of the poetry and repetition of sounds that I talked about before, with some of the alliterations that he uses. I see some of that in Langston Hughes' work, and particularly the way that he writes some of the Jesse B. Simple columns might be something that people want to check out. And again, that kind of makes the point that I was just saying, that some of this material, regardless of when it was published or came out, is pretty timeless, because it, you know, is addressing racism, white supremacy. With that, did I have anything else I wanted to make sure I get in? I think I will pause there. Did other folks have commentary they wanted to make sure they got in, if I was talking crazy or just anything else stood out that you want to share before we get to the end of the broadcast? Everyone satisfied? Soon.
Can I be heard?
Oh, yes, ma'am. Go ahead, Emmy.
I just wanted to put it on the record that I think it's a fantastic code, especially for men attempting to build families. Not just, of course, not to hit the woman, but not to hit the children either. And if you do, then it means that you've lost control of your home, of your house, and that you need to leave. I don't know, that just sounded very manly to me, and I liked it. And I wanted to comment and say that I liked it. I think that that's, I don't know, just it, there's something about it that I think is very true, very accurate, could be very helpful. Like there's a book of quotes or something like that for men. I think that'd be a good one. And that's it. Thank you.
Hear, 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 hear. Any other comments? Are folks satisfied? Everything discussed so far? Picking up next week, we'll start on Chapter 7. Anything else folks want to make sure they get in? I'll assume folks are satisfied. We'll pick up, as I said, Chapter 7. We'll be grand to weave in as much. He has a massive catalog, so obviously we won't be able to play, but I mean a brief little snippet here and there, but we'll try and weave in some of his great artistry, which pretty much all touched on racism, white supremacy in some way, shape, or form. I mean, literally, we're talking about someone who used as many of his talents as possible for decades to call attention to racism, white supremacy, and how black people all over the world were being abused. So it would be great to read the book. I think we probably have some listeners who have heard a song or two from Gil Scott here on some of his work, but don't know a lot of detail about him. So it'll be great to learn more and keep rolling. So looking forward, next Friday we'll pick up again. We'll be here tomorrow, compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll review news observations from the past 7 days as we wind down spring of 2017 and look forward to a great summer. Thanks everyone for tuning in. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. I will state again, if you're going to be out frolicking and enjoying the warm weather, you still want to be codified. Racist man, racist woman, they do not take vacations from terrorizing black people. So let's make sure that our behavior, even when we are out having fun, our behavior should still reflect that war is being waged against black people worldwide. And it's been my experience, us being intoxicated, alcohol, tobacco, cannabis, whatever it is, often it renders us or puts us in positions where we do not make quality decisions that can end up putting us in positions where racists can exploit that big time and not just mistreat us, but I mean mistreat us in ways that have, you know, lasting and damaging ramifications for years. So just keep that in mind. If you got to consume, get to one spot and stay there. That way you don't have to be out and about and run the risk of bumping into a white person when you might not be thinking your best. Might not be able to make great decisions and deal with a white person. Remember, white people are dangerous, badge or no. That cannot be overstated, repeated often enough.
That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.